The format for today's event, as always, will be remarks by our guest, followed by questions from the audience using the two microphones up front here. Because our guest must return immediately to New York this afternoon, I think it's something to do with the television show he's appearing in. But anyway, because our time is somewhat limited today, we ask that you keep your questions brief so that we'll have time to include several questions in the time available to us this afternoon. And finally, having grown up on Walter Cronkite, Dan Rather, and CBS News, it is a particular pleasure for me to welcome Dan Rather here today. And now I'd like to present Mr. Newton Minow, who is on the board of directors of CBS and is currently a fellow at the Institute of Politics. He will introduce today's guest.
I was told today that Ted Turner was one of your speakers at this series. I met Ted a few months ago in Chicago, and I was introduced to him as a member of the board of directors of CBS, and I said, Ted, I don't know if you know, but CBS is about to take over Turner Broadcasting. He said, how can you? I own 81%. I said, you may think you own 81%. And he looked at me a little suspiciously before he realized I was kidding, but CBS has really gone through quite a bit. I live in Chicago near the Oak Street Beach on Lake Michigan. One day, Mayor Daley was walking along the beach with Cardinal Cody, the Archbishop of the Catholic Archdiocese in Chicago. And it was a very windy day, and the Cardinal's red hat blew off his head into the lake. The Cardinal was very upset because it was his only red hat. Mayor Daley said, don't worry about your eminence, I'll take care of this. And he proceeded to walk into the lake on top of the water. He fished out the hat. He walked back on top of the water. He dried off the hat. He put it on the Cardinal's head. Dan Rather was in Chicago. He was hiding behind a rock at the Oak Street Beach. And he saw this. And that night, CBS News began. Dan Rather said, CBS News has a special scoop today from Chicago. Daley can't swim. CBS News, Dan Rather, and all of television news gets accused of a lot of things, the way they cover things. But those of us who follow CBS News and television news in general know that Dan, through the years, has earned the confidence, the respect of millions of Americans each and every day. In the last two decades, you've seen him cover the civil rights struggle, Vietnam, Watergate, Afghanistan, the assassinations of President Kennedy, Dr. Martin Luther King, Egyptian President Anwar Sadat. And through all that, Dan has emerged with the trust and confidence of the American people because he's earned it. He's in a tough business, a business which requires minute-by-minute decisions, a business which, by technology, I was telling him at lunch today, I rushed home 2 weeks ago today to watch the CBS coverage of the election. I found very little of it on the CBS affiliate here in Boston because of the change in the technology, the change in the economics of the business. ABC has just gone to change its network news to a different hour in New York, cutting back on the news. So we see a lot of things changing. And it's a special pleasure for me as a director of CBS and a very proud director of CBS News as well to present to you one of the best in the business and certainly the best at CBS, Dan Rather.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much for those wonderful introductions. Abe Lincoln once said about such introductions, never take the time to deny them because the audience will find out soon enough for themselves. I'm going to try something on you. I'm going to try two things that I don't often do. First, this is not one of the two things, but before I forget it, I would appreciate it if you acknowledge some friends and colleagues of mine who are here today. Rich Cohen, who is a producer with the CBS Evening News and directs our political coverage. And Suzanne Meyerowitz, who is responsible for just about every good and decent thing that comes out of our office, Suzanne. And somewhere in the audience is Harvard's own. He's on a Nieman Fellowship from CBS News at the moment, from 60 Minutes, Ira Rosen. Ira, are you here? He may have given up. Now, we had a little huddle before we came over here. That I recognize that you have a lot of things to do, particularly this time of year, and I'm very appreciative of your taking time out, particularly on a day that is not as some Boston winter days is, or can be. This is a pretty nice day, and I appreciate you being in here. That I do feel, we heard a little bit about whether I should tell you this story. We have a split in our office about the tone that this little story can set. And we may have a vote, if we have time, when this is over, as to whether I made an error or not by starting out with this story. Now, if you don't like this story, and you think it sets the wrong tone, Mr. Rich Cohn is responsible, and you may want to see him when this is over. And it goes this way. With a group such as this, with people, even people at your age, and I mean that in no patronizing way, who have accomplished so much, and let's don't duck it or dodge it, getting to an institution with a reputation such as this is a terrific accomplishment that I feel a little like Elizabeth Taylor's sixth husband. That I know what's expected of me. I think I know how to do it. I just don't know whether I can keep it interesting. Now, when I discussed with the leaders of the forum what the form would be, it's been a number of years since I've been at the forum, and quite a few years since I've been at Harvard, they gave me a version of, well, you can do it just about any way you want to do it, which reminded me of I am a Texan by birth and by choice, which Mr. Minow was kind enough not to mention. And I was born in a farming community, Wharton, which is about 3,500 people, a rural community on the coast below Houston. I grew up there, to most of you in this room, long ago and far away. It was during the Depression years, before World War II. Times were tough there, as they were nearly every place in the country. Jobs were hard to come by. And we had an opening to teach school, which is a fairly rare occurrence in our county. And there were 37 applicants, even in Wharton County, for one school teaching job. It got down to a final three, and the final three were to go to went before the school board for a final interview. Now, I know that this is a system with which you have no familiarity at all. Go before the school board, and one of the younger final three got in front of the school board, and you have to understand that the school board in Wharton, it's not a full-time job. These are members of the community. They don't have much time. They don't want to waste anybody's time. They got this young applicant up, and Mr. Leroy Jones, who was the senior member of the school board, said, "Listen, young fellow, let's get right down to it. How do you teach geography?" The applicant said, "Sir, let me tell you, I need this job so badly I can teach it round or teach it flat. You just tell me how you want it taught." The members of the senior membership of your forum said, "You can do it any way you want to do." Here's what I did. When I said I'm going to do two things I don't often do. One was to start off with the Elizabeth Taylor story, which is always a risk. The other, the other is that I wrote something. That I'm, yes, I'm a broadcaster and a reporter. I also try to write. And I didn't want to come this far, and I didn't want you to take this much out of your day without at least trying my hand at writing something and to tell you something that's on my mind. I hope it will be mercifully short, and I do want to get to your questions. If you have questions about the television business or journalism or almost anything else, I hope you'll have time to discuss it in some candid way. But one of the reasons I'm here today, I don't like to take these things on very often. I particularly don't like to take them on if I don't feel that I can get something out of it. I don't consider it my role here to give you something. I intend to take as much out of this as I get, maybe more so. But I hear an awful lot of talk around, too much of it to suit me, that people who are at institutions such as this, and particularly those who are in the advanced courses of law school or business school, I hear all the time, "Dan, you wouldn't recognize them. All they're interested in is money." You may not have heard this. I suspect that you have. I hear it all the time. And I want to be as candid with you as I hope we can be in the question and answer session. To tell you the truth, I see some empirical evidence of it from time to time, where I work and live now in New York. There's nothing wrong with making money. We can all agree about that. I hope that nobody in this room, with the great opportunities you have at this institution, I hope nobody in this room goes out of here with a thought in mind there's something wrong with making money, but I hope you won't go out without the thought that you need to put something back. This is elemental. It's fundamental. Yes, it's simplistic. And yes, my guess is that you hear it from time to time here anyway. But I'm not going to come this far and not say my piece to you about that. Part of it is I simply don't believe that the kind of character that it takes to get to a Harvard is the kind of character that's going to spend a lifetime being interested only in money and how to make a living. Yes, you want to do well, but you also want to do good. And isn't that the dilemma we all face? I can tell you that Newton Menno and I, over a lifetime of sometimes good times, sometimes tough times, have had to weigh it rather constantly and consistently. You want to do well, but you also want to do good. My guess is that you came into Harvard saying to yourself, the most important thing to me is I want to do good. What I'm told is, well, while you're here, what you learn in the rough and tumble is that doing well is the more important thing, and when you leave here, you have that on a somewhat higher scale. I hope that isn't true. I hope it won't be true of you. I don't want to be preachy with you or to you. I understand you've had at least two ordained ministers already for the forum. And what I have in the way of my written remarks, which I'll try to get through reasonably quickly, these are not observations of an intellectual. These are the observations of a working reporter. And that's said not in any self-deprecating way, that being a journalist is all I've ever wanted to do. And in that sense, I know how lucky I am, that I never could imagine doing anything else for a living than being a reporter. Now, in my time and place, that meant being a newspaper reporter. I never thought about being on radio, much less being on television. But in that, I know that I was very lucky. What a reporter gets to do is be an observer a lot. The danger in my profession is that you become a professional observer, and if you aren't careful, you never are active in anything on our scale of trying to do well as doing good. You can make of yourself, if you aren't careful, in my business, a pretty good observer, but then you find yourself always with that cop-out, well, I'm just here as an observer. You know, I don't have any thoughts of my own. I'm not active in anything on my own. So it will help me a great deal as we go through this afternoon is if you understand that I expect and want to talk with you about a good many things, but I do not consider myself to be an expert on anything. That there may be experts on the American experience as it heads toward the 21st century or on the future of the American presidency or, for that matter, on television. But if there are such experts, you'd be surprised how few of them graduated from Sam Houston State Teachers College. I don't want this to be a definitive statement. I consider these just observations, a group of observations, but observations I hope will stand up. When we talk about that dilemma, the ancient dilemma of wanting to do well and also wanting to do good, it occurs to me that we've gotten a little bit lost in this country on how to do that and what the definition in that context of being an American is. I think we've forgotten quite a bit about what we are about. Certainly if we've reached the point where the society as a whole complains that people who go to the best institutions of higher learning are in some real and present danger of being overwhelmed by concerns about how they're going to do in the material world, then we've lost our way just a bit. I keep thinking the past few days in that context of a quote from Scott Fitzgerald, which I learned somewhere along the way, I think as a senior in high school, maybe as a sophomore in college. Fitzgerald was known for writing about a time, the 20s, and a group, the so-called lost generation. But he was splendid on the subject of this country. It was always deep in his consciousness, and it helped shape and inform all of his writings. And Fitzgerald once said, "France is a place, England is a people. But America, having about it still the quality of the ideal, is harder to utter. America is graves at Shiloh, its tired, drawn faces of its great men, its country boys from Kansas dying in the Argonne Forest for a phrase that was empty before their bodies were withered. America, Fitzgerald wrote, is a willingness of heart. It's that last phrase, I think, that captures so much, a willingness of heart. A country is a place. A country is a people. It's a culture and a history. It's palpable. It exists in fixed coordinates. It's spiritual. It exists in the imagination and also in the memory. But some countries actually exist more as an ideal than anything else. And I say some countries because I don't want to be chauvinistic, but I really think of only one country that exists as an ideal, and this is the country. When Fitzgerald spoke of the willingness of heart, he did not mean only that men from this country in World War I went out and crossed the sea to defend the West when their own homes were not in danger. He wasn't only referring to the fact that that first summer in the trenches of France, that the fighting was so tough that the land cost 20 lives a foot. He was referring to the fact that we were and are a new thing in history, a totally new thing with new ideas, that all men are created equal, that they are born with natural rights to life and liberty, and it is the right of the people, capital R, capital P in the original Constitution, mind you, it's the right of the people to create and alter, if they wish, their own government. The men who wrote that document, we know, squabbled over it, they fought over it, they anguished over it throughout, and eventually they put their heads on the line when they signed it. Now, there's a willingness of heart for you. And people all over the world would in time read that document and believe it and think that we believed it too. This, I submit to you, is what has made us special and made the world believe that we were special. By the end of World War I, we were the strongest nation on earth, a conqueror of older worlds. We were considered innocents abroad in those days, clodbusters, rough kids, frontiersmen, certainly not as smooth and refined as the English and the French. Bunch of farm boys with a great hick pride staring up at Versailles and saying, you know, I like the Springfield state capital a hell of a lot better. But for all of that, the Europeans had to admire us. They didn't always want to, but they did. They admired us because we stood for something. And they knew that. We even wanted to share our good fortune, make the world safe for democracy. Never was a nobler intention sadder in its outcome. But they knew this was an ideal, and while they could be cynical in the way that older societies sometimes are, they knew we believed it. And I think all the world must have looked at us and thought, what a good people. At least, what an idealistic people. That's something new and refreshing. In World War II, pretty much the same. Good, decent people sending their young men to save the West again, this time from a destroyer of worlds. We did it with the same willingness of heart. And when it was over, and we were once again the conquerors of the world, we packed up and went home. We didn't even have a debate about it. No big national hue and cry about how our boys died for that soil and we ought to keep it because they proved that they can't run it after all. We didn't have that debate. We simply packed up and came home. It wouldn't have been like us to stay. After all, we stood for an ideal, democracy, and they deserve it the same as us. Spread it around. It's like love. The more you give it, the more you keep it. Or so it seemed, or so we thought, or so we hoped. We did stay the course long enough to rebuild those societies, rebuild the countries of the people who'd killed our people. We built Germany and Japan's factories, literally poured the foundation for the might they'd later use against us in the economic wars to follow. And they didn't seem too embarrassed about it. Maybe they said thanks, but in a way I think they expected what we did. After all, they knew that America is an ideal, a willingness of heart. Anyway, we rebuilt them quite literally with malice toward none and charity for all, and Lincoln's great heart would have exploded with pride. Jump now to the last fifth of the 20th century, the post-technological age, your time. What do they think of us now? Well, not so much. We've all traveled a little, most of us, and in other countries around the world, they don't seem to be in love with America these days, do they? A million reasons for this, some good, some not so good. But I get the impression, among others, that they believe that we, you and I, but particularly you, those of you under the age of, say, 30, I think that they believe that we've lost our spirit, that they think we've lost our spiritualism, and I think we've begun to doubt ourselves. Maybe we've judged ourselves too much by what others say. If 65 years ago, France thought we were heroes, then surely we were. And we acted the part. Now, if they think we stand for nothing, maybe that's the feeling that we stand for nothing we get among ourselves. And again, I think of Scott Fitzgerald, who called this the American disease. That is, wanting to be liked and judging oneself by what others think of one. We want to be good and kind and decent, but most of all, we want to be loved, and when we're not, we think of ourselves unlovable. Fitzgerald called that the American disease. I think it's the impression, particularly with the young people of the world, that they think your country and mine now stands for only two things. Idealism, maybe once, goes the thought overseas too often now. Now, what America stands for, this is what one man's opinion, too many of them believe, is that we only stand for militarism and materialism. On materialism, they've got us, haven't they? We are in the thrall of things. We are captivated by what we consume. Yes, Europe and Japan suffer too. It's the disease of the West, if you want to include Japan, and economically I do in the West. But let me be a chauvinist. We represent an ideal, and we're supposed to be better than that. There was an essay in the Christian Science Monitor a year or two ago, and the writer Allison Finney Jr. said, and I quote him directly, "Our age is one that presses its materialism and blandly denies anything but what the senses know. We fill up our days with business as usual, with worries, with shopping. And this trend isn't going on just in the far side of the world under communism. It's happening here in our own society," wrote Mr. Finney. And we all know he's right. We've got our individual Marshall Plans these days, and we're building for and giving to ourselves. And when people complain that particularly those of you who are still studying are too materialistic, too in the thrall of money and material things, this is precisely what they're talking about. We did this to ourselves. It's not a case of blaming you. We did this to ourselves, all of us. At least the woman standing in line for 4 hours in Moscow to buy a bolt of cloth is the victim of Lenin, who thought all spiritual concerns were a distraction from the real struggle. We are not victims of the system, and we don't have that excuse. Now, does it materialism make us strong? Of course not. Does it make us deep? Hardly. Does it make us lovable? Nope. Does it even make us happy? Well, if you're lucky, only for a moment. What it does make us is fat, and in the foreign capitals of the world, they see our waist size, and judge our souls by our waist size. And they conclude that the Yanks have gone flabby. If you don't believe it, take a semester off and travel, or do it next summer. If you've already traveled, then you know it. That's what they believe. We shouldn't live in a spiritual vacuum, and we might remember that the men who made this country, the men who invented this country, pledged not only their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor, that they, and some of you may not like this, but it's the fact that they did, referred most explicitly to the, quote, Creator. In the Declaration, they called on His help and His guidance, and they unveiled their nation as one nation under God. We might remember this. As for militarism, there's an irony in that charge. We've only been a great power since the turn of the century. I find with my own children, both of whom are grown, that they tend to think that the United States of America has been a great power militarily forever. Not so. We've been a great military power for about 80 years. Not long in the history of man and woman. In 1917, when we saved the West, we talked a lot about our love of man, love of freedom, and bringing the fruits of democracy over there. But we didn't boast in 1917 that we were the most powerful nation in the world. We certainly didn't boast that we were the most powerful military nation in the world. The national chant then was not, "We are number one." In World War II, the attitude was pretty much the same with your mothers and fathers. But in the past decades, not just you, but your mothers and fathers, and yes, I and others like me, we've changed. As our claims to being number one got weaker, as we were threatened by the might of the Soviet Union and the sheer numbers in China, as our hold on indisputable champ got weaker, we got louder. We started smacking our breastplates with our fists like some Roman centurion, and talking about how we're the richest and most powerful nation on earth, arguable at best. Naturally, the world, not being composed of a bunch of blushing flowers, rather resented this. And some of them loved it when our tax sank slowly irretrievably into the jungle floor. And some of them secretly crowed when we couldn't get our helicopters out of the desert or our diplomats out of the embassy. They still do, and they will. Now, we comfort ourselves with the symbols of might. You know, it's still true as you travel around the country, some television stations still end the broadcast day by showing flight after flight of B-52s, intercut with Old Glory whipping in the breeze, Star Spangled Banner, and a lot of military images follow. I think it's indicative of how we've changed over the last several decades. Military images are not bad in their place. You would expect someone who spent a short, undistinguished, but nonetheless a career in the Marine Corps to say that. But as Dr. Henry Kissinger once said in another context, it has the added advantage of being true. Military images are not bad in their place. But we're suggesting in those films that end the television day, and with so much else of what we say and do, particularly with all this braggadocio stuff, perhaps unconsciously, what we're saying is that our patriotism resides in our military might. Not God bless our ideals, but God bless our tanks. This is changing, but those little films, most of them made in the 60s and 70s, and how we go around the world bragging about how we're number one and we're the richest, most powerful nation on earth, tells the world a lot about how we see ourselves. And again, it's ironic because when we had the smallest army in the West, when we had the weakest military, we were the greatest nation on earth. That was in 1776. Now, I don't mean to suggest the world would be just great again if only we'd stop building tanks and high-technology aircraft and missiles. Hardly. We live in a tough neighborhood, the real world, and there are real forces arrayed against us. And part of the continuing American dream, which we're so fond of talking about, is protecting the dreamers. But there's little point in that if the dreamers don't dream anymore. And that's the point of this little written piece. When we talk about how we're the richest and most powerful nation in the world, I think we've forgotten the context in which that was said. We were rich in the old lady that James Agee talked to when he was doing his marvelous Depression piece, Let Us Now Praise Famous Men. Those of you who've read it know that Agee found her out in the hollows in the hills of Appalachia. Little shack, dirt floors, bare feet, no heat, no plumbing. And A.G. says to the woman, what would you do if someone came along and gave you some money to help you out? Maybe a lot of money. The old lady rocks in her chair, sucks in her cheeks, shakes her head. She is thinking. And finally she nods and says to A.G., I guess I'd give it to the poor. That's what we're rich in. That old lady and that kind of generosity. Our wealth was in our human resources and our natural resources. We were blessed with a continent ribbed in gold and ruled by sunlight and land. Land we could work and build on and live on and pass down. We were an immigrant race, and no one loves land like an immigrant. I think part of our problem is that we're in a kind of historical stasis. History has left us kind of undefined. One mark of American has always been a certain restlessness, a certain feeling that he's not quite fully defined. We're not pioneers carving out the West anymore. We're not great patriots creating a country or farm boys defending the West from tyrants and trying to spread democracy. At least we don't think of ourselves as those things anymore, do we? Maybe we feel there's nowhere to push off to now, so no point in packing a copy of the Constitution to take with us. I know space is the last frontier. And I agree with that to a degree, but you can't read the Bill of Rights to a star. For one thing, they're very quiet, and they do not listen very well. The point of this is that I suggest to you that with the marvelous opportunities that you have, blessed as you are to have the greatest opportunities in the greatest country of economic potential in the world, it is worth remembering as you go about your work, and particularly when you leave here, what our marvelous strengths are. Strengths such as we're a flexible people, we adjust to change. Strengths such as we still believe, yes, we still believe, in the ideals. And we spend less time thinking about our imagined strengths, money, and military might. Thank you very much. Now, Thank you. Thanks. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Thanks. I want to make one point. I know you have a lot of people coming in front of you. If you didn't like the way that was written, you only have one person to blame. I'm the person. No, I don't write everything that I say. That I wrote. I'm sorry it took a little longer to read it than I thought it might. Let's get that out of the way and go to your questions. I do not consider that the questions need to be confined to or even in any way on that point. I'm prepared to try to talk with you about anything on your mind. About anything on your mind. Yes, sir.
This may be an unreasonable question, but I wondered if you could briefly describe where you get your worldview. What has influenced it? What forms it? I ask it because I'm somewhat surprised by your worldview and your concept of what the world thinks and has thought of the United States. I have the impression that for 40 years, much of the world, including many people that we consider our friends, have thought that the United States is a rather foolish nation and perhaps dangerously foolish. Are you not aware of that view?
First, let me take first things first. I don't think there are any unreasonable questions. I think there are a lot of unreasonable answers. I'll try not to give you one. I get my worldview, one, mostly from traveling, talking to people, using my eyes, ears, and mind.
What kind of people?
That's where I get it. Sorry?
What kind of people? Talking to what kind of people? The elite or really the...
I wish it were so.
Okay.
No, not talking to elite. By the nature of my job, sometimes I talk to, I'm not quite sure what your definition of elite, but sometimes I talk to the powerful and sometimes I talk to the powerless. I have no illusions that I don't get a chance to talk to everybody. I don't get to talk to all stratas of all societies when I travel. But you ask me where I get my idea, that's where I get it. Perhaps you and I disagree. If we do, that's all right. I'm frequently wrong, and I may be wrong about this. That's my view. I thought about it. Tried to look you in the eye and tell you that's the way I see it. Now, I'm not sure, however, that we disagree. You mentioned the last 40 years. That's four decades. I think I said over the last several decades.
I thought you meant 20 years. If you meant 40 years, then I agree with
my
you.
My point is that up to and including World War II, and in the immediate post-war period, which would take us through the period of the Marshall Plan, I don't think you and I are in disagreement.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Rather, I agree with you very much that one of the prime problems I think we're facing today is a sort of a spiritual and intellectual, for want of a better word, malaise in this country. And one of the aspects that I think you have direct connection with that has troubled me is in recent years on television news that it seems to me has drifted more and more towards, shall we say, graphic portrayals of violent events. And I realize that the world is a violent place, but it troubles me that more and more we seem to be concentrating in the, especially the national news broadcast and also the local news, on graphic, dramatic portrayals of violence. And I wonder whether, in some sense, that is a response to a pressure that I read about that the news departments are feeling in terms of trying to hold viewers. And it was mentioned by Mr. Minow, the change from, say, 7 o'clock to 6:30 that some of the news programs are doing so they won't have to compete with Wheel of Fortune. And I just wonder your view on whether or not you see that as a problem and whether or not you see that that may have some impact on sort of deadening our consciousness to sort of graphic violence, which we are exposed to again and again.
I think that's fair criticism. That kind of criticism is on the increase, and I'm sorry to say I think it's on the increase probably because we deserve it. I'm speaking now as a broad generality for television and television news. Violence is a fact of life. It's a reality. And insofar as we reflect the reality, showing you violence, even graphically showing you violence, sometimes is consistent with our responsibility with what I perhaps too often call our public trust. It can be overdone. It is overdone. I do not accept myself or us, that is to say CBS News, from that criticism. Naturally, I'd like to believe we do a better job than Sun, but again, I don't accept us from that criticism. Now, as to the pressures that create that, I'm a firm believer in responsibility and accountability. Now, I'm accountable for the CBS Evening News. And the times when you see too much violence too graphically portrayed on the CBS Evening News, the responsibility for that is mine. It's a shared responsibility with my colleagues, but I have the responsibility of leadership, and I'm accountable for that. The ratings pressure to which you refer is also real. It's a fact of life. Never has it been a fiercer fact of life for us. And it does sometimes result in excess. It sometimes results in a pandering to what we believe, frequently wrongly, but what we believe may bring viewers to the set. This is a very old problem in journalism, print as well as broadcasting. I take your point that you're talking about broadcasting, which is you need circulation, i.e. ratings, to stay in business. We are a business. Not only do we accept that, I prefer it that way, which is another subject for another day. But commercial television in this country, we made a decision, we made a societal decision a long while ago that most television in this country is going to be run as a business. And news is part of that. Now, newspapering, magazines, you name it, everybody has their version of the circulation concern, ratings pressure. And we have ours. And yes, that affects what we put on the air. And yes, sometimes not for the better. I can't stand here and say to you, well, I'm oblivious to ratings pressure. For one thing, I'm not. For another, you would recognize it as an untruth. I do believe that it's fair to judge a broadcast or a broadcast journalist over a reasonable length of time on the basis, one measure of how good he is or how bad he is, how professional he is, how unprofessional he or she is, on the basis of how well he or she resists the temptation to do a story or to do a story in a certain way, such as a story on violence, simply to help the circulation or to help the ratings. But the criticism, I come back to it and emphasize, I think is valid. Yes, sir.
At the end of the summer, you ended broadcast with the word courage.
Right.
Why that word? Why then? And why did you stop?
Well, why that word? I like the word. And I've used the word over a period of years. I sign letters and notes sometimes with it. I sometimes say to people, courage. I used it because I like the word. Why then? It just occurred to me I thought it was a good time to try it. I rather thought, well, you know, I don't like to fall into a rut. I like to try new things. I like for us to have a sense on our broadcast of we try new things. It was the end of the summer, and I thought it was a good time. Now, why did I stop? I stopped for the following reasons. First, I was the single only person on our broadcast who thought it was a good idea to even try it. Much less stick with it. That was a factor. But I gave myself what you would expect, a good courage talk, and saying, listen, I can tack against the wind. It takes real courage, and everybody else in the shop is saying this is a bad idea to stick with it. Some would call that foolishness. I called it courage. But in the end on this decision, this gets to the answer of why we stopped. This is one of those decisions in which we honey-duted. That I came home one Friday after trying it all week, and my wife said, listen, Dan, I know everybody's talked to you about this. I'm telling you, you ought to stop it. And she gave me her version of honey-do-it, and we honey-duted. Yes, sir. I'm sorry.
In the past couple weeks, we heard a lot that the president didn't want the networks to tell about what was happening in Iran because it would possibly hurt the release or prospects for release of more hostages. And people like you probably control, to an extent at least, what the population hears. What type of thoughts go through your mind, and how did you react?
Well, that's a fair question. It's the kind of question we face among ourselves, often in other contexts. This one, frankly, was a fairly easy one for us to answer, because let's understand the fact situation. Secret weapons being sent to the Ayatollah Khomeini's regime, this was not a secret from the Iranians. It was not a secret from the Soviets. It was not a secret from the Syrians. The only people this was a secret from were the American people and some of our allies in Europe. We'll take the responsibility. That's number one. Number two, this, quote, secret, unquote, which was not so secret, was revealed to the American people and to those who didn't know it, including our allies in Europe, by the Iranians in Iran. It wasn't a case of this being leaked. It wasn't a case of the press ferreting this out. We didn't, I'm sorry to say. On a terrific story like this, you always like to think you were responsible for breaking it. We weren't. Iranians in Iran bragged about it. We've got the, quote, great Satan on the run again. You know, they're in here buttering up to us and delivering these weapons. Ain't that terrific? Now, that's the way it broke. So when we had a discussion about this as a story, our discussion was, holy smoke, have we really missed a story? Do you mean to tell me that Ronald Reagan, who got elected president, partly on the basis of what, for whatever it may be worth, I personally thought at the time, was a very good argument that President Carter had not handled the situation of the hostages in Iran very well, partly on that basis, that Ronald Reagan, who has been saying that publicly that his policy was, we do not deal with terrorist states, has been in fact dealing with a terrorist state, cuddling up to them, giving them weapons, while at the same time saying publicly his policy was something else? Now, that's the kind of discussion we had, rightly or wrongly. As for endangering the hostages, one, I hope that what has happened does not endanger the life of the hostages. I hope that nothing that we do will in any way endanger any hostage's life. My job is to report the news. When Ronald Reagan says one thing publicly and does another thing privately, such as shipping arms to Iran, the Iranians in Iran brag about it, that's a story. Not only can I not do anything about it except report it, I think it's my responsibility to report it. I think the president has the hostage's best interest in mind. I hope that he will grant that we as reporters have the hostage's best interest in mind. He made a decision. He's accountable for that decision. I cannot respect any argument that goes along the line, and mark well, I've not heard the president make this argument, but I can't respect any argument that says, listen, the secret arms deal with the Iranians is not the problem for the hostages. The problem is that the American press finally found out about it from the Iranians and started printing it is the problem. It also is maybe worth noting that since the secret arms were sent to Iran, more hostages have been taken. There are a lot of questions to be asked in this whole area. You make these decisions. You hope that they're right. You hope they bring the outcome that you seek if you're a president or on the National Security Council. But you are, in our system, you are accountable. And if you're going to say, well, letting news of this out endangers the hostages, my answer is, I'm sorry, sir, I didn't let the news out. The Iranians did. And also, respectfully, sir, I didn't make a policy of trying to deal in secret with such undependable folk as these. You did. But let's hope that the hostages aren't endangered by what's happened.
Thank you.
Welcome. Yes, ma'am.
In line with you wanting us to do well and to do good, some presidential candidates are suggesting a year of mandatory public service after high school. It'd be non-military. What would you think of that?
I want to make sure I understand the question. A universal service?
Right, mandatory.
Mandatory. I'm sorry. That's the word I missed.
Yeah.
I favor universal service, not universal military service. You've asked a personal opinion. I don't mind giving it, but please mark.
That's
my own personal opinion.
Right.
That in a particularly in a big continental country such as ours, with such a diverse population, the value of shared experience, the value of shared contributions, I think it's valuable, may be a necessity, and I favor some form of universal service. In my view, it ought to include but not be restricted to military service, which is to say I'm convinced that a form of universal service could be put into effect, that those who wanted to serve in the military be allowed to do so, and perhaps there'd be some kind of premium placed on that, but those who did not want to would be able to serve in some other way. And for my money, when I say universal service, I mean universal service. I mean men, women, physically abled, and otherwise. that only in extreme cases would there be an exception. Now, having said that I favor it, I'd say honestly, I don't see any real prospect that any such universal service is going to be implemented anytime soon. Yes, sir.
I have a quick question about the content of your medium and one question about the form of it. The form question would be, do you think that there's a limit to which we should stop the centralization of ownership of the broadcast outlets and the newspapers? We used to have thousands of papers and stations owned by many hundreds of people. It's down to a couple of dozen owners, and they're increasingly like-minded. And that was the form question. The content question is, I agree with your evaluation of our country's standing in the world, but if you look at what the medium is showing the world, we're syndicating Dallas and Dynasty in over 100 countries, and there's more than 7 or 8 hours of television watched a day in this country, and it's fairly debasing compared to what it was in the 50s and 60s. It got increasingly so in the 70s, and it's getting outrageous in my viewpoint, but I'm wondering what your viewpoint is. Can it get any worse in terms of the materialism that's being sold by the medium, and will the people who own it continue to get smaller and smaller in number?
Well, as to the first, I favor a free market system, which we have, for both newspapers and broadcasting. As regards broadcasting, I have difficulty with what I'm told is described as a completely unbridled free market system, in that there is a limit, a limited number of frequencies. That's the reason we have the Federal Communications Commission. But this is clearly a subject we could spend the rest of the afternoon discussing. But one, I favor the free market system. If it turns out that more and more newspapers are like-minded, I'm not sure you're right about that, by the way, and that more and more broadcasting stations, radio and television, are like-minded, if that's a result of a free market economy, we'll live with it and I'll take it. As for the decreasing idealistic content of programming, again, with respect, I don't think it was better in the 1950s and 60s. I don't think that the 50s were a golden era of television. Just to say, there was a lot of trash on then as well. The broadcast day was somewhat shorter than it is today. Again, this is a problem. It's a problem for which I do not have the answer, nor do I have the solution. I would look with favor on any reasonable solution, which that in addition to the Dallases and Dynasties, Wheel of Fortunes that dominate the schedule now, and I think they always will, that helps us strike a balance. I'm committed to the view free market system has to be run as a business. Commercial television in this country is primarily entertainment. But when I separate broadcasting from newspapering in this particular instance, but that those who have the licenses are responsible for meeting a public trust. And that public trust includes, in addition to putting on entertainment, a certain amount of news, public information, public service, and community service. Now, how we strike that balance is part of our ongoing experiment in this country, how we strike that balance and keep a free market economy and keep it as a business as opposed to something state-run. I can only say, I don't know how much you travel, I suspect quite a bit. Every time I get to thinking, boy, you know, maybe we ought to have some kind of state-run system, at least for a part of it, then I go look at one of these state-run systems, and I can't stay awake. So I don't understand. I really don't know. I don't have the answer to how you strike the balance. Mm-hmm. Clearly, we need a better balance than we have now. How to achieve it, I'm not certain. Yeah. Yes,
thank you.
Yes, we have time for two more quick questions. Okay. Your predecessor, Walter Cronkite, did very well and did very good in your position. He always wishes, however, that he had done better by serving the American people in the United States Senate. My question to you is, would you consider in the future?
No. I am what I am, and I know what I am, and I'll be lucky to hold on what I've got. Yes, ma'am.
Hi. I have a question that relates to a couple that have been broached earlier, and mainly the effect of the ratings war on quality of your coverage and the nature of your coverage. Specifically, I'm interested in a lot of complaints have arisen when you've covered actual terrorist events, TWA hijacking, the big one. And after you cover it, everyone complains and sits around and says, we shouldn't have done that, and then we hear nothing more. Is something going on behind the scenes in this area, maybe in other areas, to say, look, these are areas we shouldn't compete. There's lies on the line. Should we cooperate, have a pooling system, not chase hostage families around?
The answer to the question is there much going on behind the scenes about that? The answer is not much. Ours is a fiercely competitive business, sometimes too fiercely competitive. And again, I do not accept myself from that. We have a competitive system. It does not always work perfectly. Sometimes it works terribly. The struggle again is to come up with some system that's better, and we don't have one. Now, specifically about terrorism, we've made our mistakes. I've made mine. I have no doubt that we will make some in future. We, as with so many others in all of civilized society, are learning as we go how to deal with terrorist acts. I think our coverage has gotten better. I think our judgments have gotten sounder in what we cover and what we don't cover, and when we bridle in our competitive instincts and when we don't. I like to think we've gotten better about it. We've always tried to be responsible. I wouldn't argue with anyone on a specific case who detailed something and said, well, I think you were irresponsible with that. Perhaps we have been. Governments don't know how to deal with terrorism. Individuals don't know how to deal with terrorism, and journalists don't really know how to deal with terrorism, not in every specific event. Each one is different. No two are the same. You mentioned the TWA. The TWA taking was different from any number of others that we've had. This is the truth. Most of the time, we don't know what to do. We use our experience. We count on our instincts. We hope our judgment is reasonable. We are competitive. We want to be accurate and fair, and once we're accurate and fair, yes, we'd like to be first and ahead of the other person. But one of the ways I think the coverage has improved, that just in the last year, year and a half, I sense a lot less competitive drive on terrorist stories than on most other kinds of stories. That's about the best we can do. I think we'll take one more question, and then I have miles to make.
Yeah, Mr. Rather, my name is Steve Longo. I'm a journalism student at Boston University. I'd like to know, one, what type of college degree you hold, and how important do you feel a degree in journalism really is as far as getting a job in the field once you graduate?
Well, I have a degree in journalism. That's the only earned degree that I have. And for my money, those are the only ones that count for anything. That I have a degree in journalism from Sam Houston State Teachers College in Huntsville. Those of us who went there know it to be the Harvard of our part of the world. But we're perfectly aware a lot of people this far north never heard of the place. I did do some postgraduate study, but not much. If I had to do over again, I wouldn't major in journalism. If your teacher is here, I hope he doesn't accost me after this. You've asked me, I tell you. I wanted to be a reporter. I went to school not knowing much other than my mother wanted me to get a teacher's certificate in addition because she didn't think I could make a living as a reporter, and she was almost right. I wouldn't major in journalism if I had it to do over again, although I got a very good education at that small backwoods school because I had one really gifted teacher who cared, which is about all you need. But nonetheless, please don't take this as a recommendation as to what's best for you. You'll have to decide that. I wish I'd taken more history. I wish I'd taken more physics. I never understood physics and still don't. I wish I'd taken a greater variety of subjects. My difficulty when I look back on it of having majored in journalism is a number of the courses in journalism are things that I could have learned on the outside. There's some other things that are so much more difficult to learn on the outside. Undergraduate time is such a precious time. I wish I had used it better. Listen, you've been terrific with me. I want to leave you with one story, which I told you before. You know, some of the things I tell you are true. Some of them may be a little not so much so. This story has the added advantage of being true as well. Those of you who know my home state, there's a huge ranch called the King Ranch. At one time, it was the world's largest ranch. I don't think it is anymore. But suffice to say, it covers a lot of the countryside. And a policeman in New York, Roy North and his wife, came down to visit South Texas once. And they loved it so that when Roy North retired, he bought 7 acres down in South Texas, what he called his ranch. He bought it on either side of the Nueces River. He had 3 acres on one side and 4 acres on the other. And when he and Mrs. North went down there and they went got retired, Mr. North just sat out on his porch, rock, and would watch the countryside. It's flat land. You can see a long way. The Kleebergs, a legendary Texas family who owned the King Ranch next door, Mrs. Kleeberg said to Mr. Kleeberg, you know, we have neighbors over here, and you really ought to go over and say hello. Mr. Kleberg went over one morning and said, howdy, my name's Kleberg, I have the place next door. And Mr. North got up and said, my name's North, and I have this little ranch here. Now, there's an awkward moment among men. I find that women rarely have this awkward moment. But among men, frequently, when you meet a stranger, you say hello and introduce yourself, then there's an awkward moment you don't know what to say next. Women always seem to know what to say. Men rarely seem to know what to say in that awkward moment. Mr. Kleberg sort of dabbled with his boots and said, well, Mr. North, how many acres you got here? And Roy North from New York City said, oh, he said, I've got 7 acres. He said, I got 3 acres on the other side of the river, and I got 4 acres on this side of the river. Mr. Kleberg smiled. He said, you know, Mr. North, he said, I told you I live next door. He said, some mornings on my ranch, I can get up and get in my car in the morning, and I can drive all day and not reach the other side of my ranch. And Roy North said, oh, you know, I had a car like that once. Thank you very much.